This Week in Retronauts, we're not even human. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this is an episode full of fake robot drones from the Feca Corporation. And we are here to talk disgraceful things about NEC and Hudson's grand experiment of the late 80s, the NEC TurboGrafx 16, also known as the PC Engine, also known as the PC Engine Duo, also known as the Laser Active. It was a lot of things, many things to many people, and we're going to talk about many of them because we are many people. Who are the many people who are here in the studio with me today?
Hey, it's Bob Mackey, and I am a loser of the contest to name AirZonk, officially. This is not a joke. I lost the contest.
Oh. I'm Rock Hard Caveman Ray Barnholt.
This is Shane Bettenhausen, frequent contributor. And also, I don't like how you've already framed the TurboGrafx 16 negatively by bringing up Johnny Turbo and, like, the whole thing's like a joke.
True.
No, Zonk is awesome.
Yeah, no, really, like—
I stand by Zonk in the soundtrack.
You've already set this the stage for this
we
to be—
We always do this with podcasts, Shane Bettenhausen.
Scandalous.
This is how we are.
We're here to celebrate the revival of this classic
We are. This
franchise.
Episode is happening because Konami suddenly remembered that back about 15 years ago, it bought Hudson. And said, man, we should do something with this rich IP besides just posting untranslated games to the Wii U Virtual Console. And so we are getting the PC Engine Mini, the TurboGrafx Mini.
Micro consoles are still all the rage.
They're not, but I'm very excited about this one because it really feels like it is the deepest cuts of all the mini consoles that have existed to date. It has lots of untranslated Japanese games on it, I believe.
It is cool. And again, maybe you'll get into this, how there's like three different versions of this thing coming out. Are you going to talk about all that? Or?
Sure. We can start from the beginning. Yeah. I mean, I checked it out at Tokyo Game Show last year. And
well, and it's cool. They actually,
I was really impressed with the quality of it.
They introduced this like a year before it came out or something.
Yeah.
Like we had a long time to get excited about the Turbo coming back.
Yeah. And the like you said, there are three different versions. There is the standard PC Engine Mini for Japan. There is the TurboGrafx Mini for America. And then there's the Core Graphix, which apparently is designed to kind of reflect Europe because TurboGrafx wasn't really a thing in Europe. Like, it was kind of only released there. But apparently the representative I talked to, the guy who's producing this at Konami, said, yeah, you know, like, people imported it in Europe and what they tended to get was the Core Graphix.
Yeah.
So this is the British version, like the European version of the Mini. But the funny thing about the PC Engine Mini is that it's really not, because the PC Engine console itself was so small that the PC Engine Mini is only like, it's like 30% smaller as opposed to 70% smaller, right, like the other mini consoles, because it was just such a great little piece of engineering. Like, Hudson and NEC really just put together a remarkable little system. It was very powerful despite being like the size of a CD case. It was tiny, barely bigger than the controller that came with it. And it wasn't a big controller. It was like an NES, you know, sized controller. It was a crazy little system, and it had something like 19 different variants released through the years across all regions, including CD add-ons,
like
a failed expansion.
I'm a fan of the shuttle graphics.
The shuttle, yeah, the one that's kind of like rounded.
Looks like a space shuttle.
It kind of looks like the N64 before the N64.
Well, as we rewind here to the PC Engine, what, 1983? Is that the debut?
No, what? 87.
No, 87.
Oh, I won't say anything thinking about it. 83 is Famicom, so 87 is PC Engine.
You're a little ahead of yourself.
Bleeding
there.
Edge.
We first hear about it 88, but like when NES was first coming to America, I had no idea this thing existed in Japan. Did any of you know that this console existed?
Oh, no way.
There wasn't really the media support at the time. It wasn't until the NES kind of picked up in the US that game magazines really became a thing again. Before that point, they were all pretty much just PC focused.
Right. I don't think I'd ever seen anybody talk about the existence of this thing until like that Video Game Buyer's Guide 1988 that talked about the Sega Mega Drive and the first early shot of like Super Famicom, and that talked about the PC Engine. And I'm like, wait, there's a console that's out in Japan that has games that is popular? Huh?
Yeah. You didn't tell me about it? How could you?
Yep, and that kind of was the ghost that haunted TurboGrafx throughout its life, was just poor messaging and poor promotion. It's a shame because it's a great little system, but the story of the PC Engine in Japan is very different than the story of the TurboGrafx-16 in America. We're going to talk about that. And it is not all negative because I think we all have many positive things to say about the PC Engine, TurboGrafx. It's just, you know, you can't really tell the American story of this thing without the big asterisk next to it of like Hudson and or NEC and TTI just did not know what to do with this thing and how to position it. And, you know, it launched 2 years after the Japanese version, which was also like 2 weeks after the Sega Genesis launched in the U.S. And as great a system as it was compared to the NES, it just didn't quite stack up to the legitimately next generation Sega Genesis. So, you know, it was a very haunted system in a lot of ways.
Most of us here are old enough to remember this happening. And like, you know, NES and to a lesser extent Sega Master System were my life. You know, like me and my friends spent like literally every waking moment thinking about these things. So we were eagerly anticipating the Sega Genesis, but much less so the TurboGrafx-16. I was curious about it. I was like, you know, I didn't quite understand it. And I remember the advertising, the print ad at launch, you know, the three-page ad, like comparing a screenshot of Super Mario Brothers to a screenshot of Vigilante. And me, like,
I think it's Vigilante.
Vigilante, the European pronunciation.
It's not the French version.
I had played Vigilante in the arcade, and I had beat Super Mario Brothers many times. And I knew, well, okay, even though Vigilante has better graphics, Super Mario Brothers is a better game. It's one of the greatest games ever made. And at Toys R Us or Children's Palace, you could go and play at launch a demo of Keith Courage and Alpha Zones. And although I kind of like Keith Courage, I looked at this and I was like, this is an altered beast. These graphics aren't that great. I don't need to tell my parents that this is the thing I need to buy.
Keith Courage was maybe not the best choice of a pack-in. I don't know that I actually played a TurboGrafx until like 1999 or 1990
wow.
or so.
Oh, there were in-store demos at launch.
I don't remember seeing it in stores. The place I saw it was at a Putt-Putt. After a while, in the late 80s, early 90s, the Putt-Putt near us built this little like console arcade in addition to their arcade.
Free?
It wasn't. No. You would pay like for a little bit of time on the game systems. And one of those was a TurboGrafx, and I was like, oh, I can finally see
what,
this.
What
hey,
games
it's Bonk.
Did they have Legendary Axe at least?
It was Bonk.
It was Bonk. So this was a year and a half later at least, because Bonk was not a launch title.
No, it was I'm pretty sure it was around 1991 actually, okay. Now that I think about it, because around the same time they started selling some of the games that they had, I guess the cartridges that weren't popular, and that's where I bought Metal Storm.
Weird.
So that would have been 91.
Right.
I'll also say by me, there were no rental places where one could rent any of the games.
That's true, yeah.
Nobody carried it. Blockbuster didn't carry it. Mom and Pop didn't carry it. Nobody carried it.
I'm sure I drooled over pictures of, you know, the giant green dinosaur in Bonk's Adventure that they would always show off in screenshots.
Again, that's not launched, not available at launch.
Right.
Not even announced at launch.
But I didn't get one until 1992, and that's when I believe it was cut to $100. Mm. So that's I was like, oh, that's an easy sell for my parents, and these are games I have never seen or touched before.
Yeah. So none of us bought this at launch. None of us even played it at launch.
No.
Shortly after launch, Legendary Axe came out and was very well reviewed. Got nines across the board everywhere. It had a giant last boss that you saw screenshots of that looked really cool. And that was the first like FOMO, like, oof, that is kind of a game I actually want to play, but I'm not, I can't play this. No one has it. Yeah. Also, I was a big Galaga 88 fan, and this game did have Galaga 88 as Galaga 90, which was like the second game I kind of wanted to play. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I remember thinking, Sega Genesis is amazing. It's so good. I was like a super Sega Genesis
fan. Look at those graphics on Altered Beast.
Ghouls and Ghosts, Golden Axe, everything. Ren of Shinobi, Phantasy Star 2. So like early on, it became like this was the third tier system. It was like I didn't know a single person who had it. It seemed weird. And I was always curious about it, but not curious enough to actually save up my allowance and have shown the interest in this thing.
Yeah. For me, I think like most of us in this country, it was only you knew a friend who had one. And I did for a little while. I think actually it was a hand-me-down from his older brother. But at least his brother had good taste and had some of the good early games like Bonk and Dungeon Explorer and stuff. So I played that for a little bit. But yeah, I even bought it after Bob did a year after that when they dropped it to $60.
Oh, wow. Is that 93?
Yeah.
Wow.
Basically. And then I bought it then finally. And by the way, I'd always wanted it. Like post-launch and seeing the advertising of Bonk and stuff, I'd always wanted something to do with TurboGrafx, especially Turbo Express. But then I actually got the system. Of course, it came with Keith Courage and Bonk's Revenge at that time. So you got
that's the one I got.
Yeah. So I got that set, and then it like mysteriously died. I think our house had some wiring problems.
Oh no! I think that was an issue with the hardware because mine mysteriously died
well,
too.
Yeah. I also lost a Sega CD the same way.
So that's also a shoddy system.
So I don't know, but
that's an expensive thing to lose.
Yeah, it was. So, but so, I didn't get until my first trip to Japan. I got a Core Graphics 2.
Nice.
And now I have one again physically. Well,
so I didn't own a TurboGrafx as much as I thought they were interesting and unique. I just didn't have the money or the space for one until 2005, I want to say, at PAX. Maybe it's 2006 when I bought a Turbo Duo and a copy of Dracula X, Rondo of Blood. Wow. And I bought that at Pink Gorilla Games, which is not, yeah. at the time was Pink Godzilla. Yeah. That was, I think that was on the 1UP show, so it would have been 2006. Wow. It was like a PAX coverage kind of thing, and they got footage of me like holding, brandishing my purchase, my long coveted purchase. I finally got to play Dracula X. And then like 6 months later, they announced it for PSP. So yes, that was 2006. That's when I finally got it. It is a great little system.
Let's rewind to 1990.
Actually, I want to rewind a little further into the past and talk about the history of
How did NEC come to make this thing? And that, I'll say, like, at the time of launch here in America, there was like a young Shane being like, wait a minute, like Nintendo makes Nintendo games, Sega makes Sega games. Who is making this thing?
Yeah,
who are making these games?
It was very nebulous. And the fact of the matter is that there were two companies involved. There was Hudson and there was NEC, both Japanese companies. Hudson, of course, we've talked about a lot. They're the company that is now owned by Konami, and they were kind of on the software side. They were founded in the early 70s, named after the founder's love of trains, I believe.
Huh.
And they initially sold General Electronics, but in the late 70s, after the Space Invaders boom, they were like, we should get into that. And they did. And then in the around that time, they started actually developing games or publishing them and then developing them later. And they just kind of inundated the market with a ton of stuff for PCs, and it wasn't necessarily great. But in 83, they said, what if we made some good games? And that's around the time I think they created Bomberman. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And they kind of hit it big by being the first third-party licensee for Nintendo's Famicom in summer of 1984. And not only were they first to enter that very, very vibrant market that was about to explode into becoming a national phenomenon, a global phenomenon, they made a really smart choice by taking a game they had licensed for a computer conversion from the US, Lode Runner, and converting it to Famicom. And even though they had to cut back on it, they gave it like cool new graphics, not cool, but cute new graphics, like very personality-filled new graphics instead of the little stick man that Doug Smith had created. And that combination of things made them very, very wealthy and very successful. And so they made lots of games for Famicom and NES, and they also made lots of games for PCs, most notably those by NEC, which means something or other. Does anyone know what NEC stands for?
Oh, I'm sure it's Nippon something.
Something. Electric Company, maybe? Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, NEC had been around nearly as long as Nintendo. They were founded in the late 19th century as a telephone and electric company.
Wow.
And they moved into computing around the early 80s and released some of the mainstay home computers for the Japanese market, the PC 6601 and the PC 8801 and the 9801, each of which was like progressively more powerful than the other.
Yeah. They were the ones who basically had the PC branding in Japan, which is where the PC Engine comes from, of course.
Yep.
But yeah, they were the ones who kind of won out in the early days as far as all the different computer platforms that they had back then.
Was PC 88 kind of like an Amiga competitor?
No, PC 88 was an 8-bit system. The 9801 was 16-bit, so that's more along the lines of Amiga. Yeah, they were both, you know, pretty solid systems, but Japan had kind of unique needs in terms of computing because of language and text entry and so forth. And, you know, American systems, European systems just didn't really meet those needs. So NEC kind of had – they didn't have the market to themselves. Sharp was also a big competitor, and there was the MSX standard. But I think when you look back on kind of like classic original Japanese PC games throughout the mid – early to mid 80s, it tends to be, you know, games that debuted on 8801, 9801, you know, Falcom. That's where they kind of sowed their oats.
Is the PC Engine kind of a consoleification of the PC-88?
No.
No.
Literally, no. It's just a branding, really.
Yeah. The PC, the TurboGrafx PC Engine, that uses like the same processor family as the Famicom, the NES, whereas PC-88 and 98 did not. It really is like they just collaborated. NEC and Hudson got together and were like, what if instead of us making games for Nintendo's console, we had our own console with hookers and blackjack? And NEC was like, yeah, we can do that. We've got hookers right here.
I do think that the format, the Hue card format, is really interesting. And like that was one of the things that I did think was cool about TurboGrafx 16 when I saw the cards.
Right.
It seemed hip.
Everything about it was so tiny and cute and appealing.
Well, okay, the TurboGrafx 16 is not tiny nor cute.
No, because Americans don't like tiny. Let's fill our system with some empty space, just like Atari.
Excuse me. Sorry. I thought we were still in Japan here.
I wish we were. Yeah, the PC Engine is very cute and small and white and kind of like, you know, very minimalistic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until they all shattered, I thought it was cool the games came in jewel cases as a kid. Right. Like, wow, it's like a CD.
Yeah. That actually threw me when I saw those for rental at shops. I was like, wait, I thought this was a cartridge system.
But there's like a clip in there holding
it
down.
But it's like
it
a
down.
CD.
Yeah, it's
like a little money clip
it's
inside.
Cool. Yeah.
At the rental shop, and it has an actual manual, not the Permastruct manual.
Right.
Yeah, the Hue cards that they published games on initially were little wafers about the size of a credit card, kind of built on the same technology as the B cards that Hudson made for MSX and Sega made for the SG-1000,
the My cards. Right. And like as a Master System person, I was always baffled by the My cards and never quite understood the Sega cards, like why they even existed.
Yeah, that was definitely a carryover from Japan that didn't make a lot of sense here. It just gave us like some very, very low capacity games that needed a special adapter.
Basically, SG-1000 games.
Ghost House kind of good.
Nah, not really. Transbot's okay. It's, you know, kind of like one of the Macross games, but not bad. That's the history. Now, what were you saying about 1990, Shane?
So, by 1990, I was like happy that I made the decision to be a Genesis super fan and not get the TurboGrafx. And then I remember EGM, like it was about the time when the TurboGrafx CD was coming out for $399.99, which is like a zillion dollars.
U.S. dollars.
In U.S. in like modern money. East Book 1 and 2 came out and got a 10. Like Ed Semrad gave it a 10 out of 10 in EGM. Yeah. No game had ever received a 10, ever. And there's a screenshot of Fina, Anime Girl. And I was like, oh my fucking God.
Right.
Why don't I have this console? I can never afford this thing. So in the back of my mind was like, one day I'll play this game.
Did you eventually?
Yes. So
okay,
if you fast forward then to 1991 when I purchased my like TurboGrafx CD, Dracula X, all these
things.
That's
not even really fast forwarding. That's more like, you know, skip 30 seconds on the podcast player.
Well, yeah. So like in the future, by the time it has clearanced, you know, by years later, I have money and Rec Games Video Marketplace, I buy all this.
I was the same
way.
Have
a good time, yeah.
Except my fast forward was 2008 when they came to Wii Virtual Console. It's like, okay, finally I can play all these expensive TurboGrafx 16 CD games.
Well, and we have a good friend who, if you rewind to the previous version of Alternate Earth Retronauts, Christian Nutt, he was my friend who had all these things at the time. He had East 1 and 2 on like day of release, and he, as my
friend. You guys knew each other as kids?
We knew each other pretty early on,
and
he was always telling me that I need to play these games. So eventually, when I did break down and buy it, I was like, remember putting in East Book 1 and 2 first, before Dracula X. It's like the first game I'm going to play is East Book 1 and 2. And I couldn't get over that the combat was like bumping into people. Eventually, I did get over the combat, but like it showed me that even like arriving just like a few years later, like, you know, this was only like 3 or 4 years after this had been a 10 out of 10, you kind of had to be there.
I mean, even at the time, like we just lacked the context for a lot of these games, which I think is another reason TurboGrafx didn't do so well here, is because a lot of these games were kind of immersed in the history of Japanese PC games. We didn't have Hydlight here.
True, yeah.
So we weren't used to games that had the bump-style combat.
Right. Didn't also Draga have bump combat too?
Yeah.
Like RAM
kind
combat?
Of. You like hold down
it's
the
weird.
Attack button and
oh,
you,
like
you,
phasing
you
through
drop
combat.
Your yeah, you drop your sword and or your shield and
but
hold out your sword.
I'll say I give NEC, TTI, everyone a lot of credit. If you do play those 1990 CD-ROM games, if you play Final Zone 2, East Book 1 and 2, like, no one had really done this before, had, like, localized games like this with voices and stuff. Like, you know, as bad as some of it is, like, it was, like, unexplored territory.
Someone had to start.
Someone had to start.
Yeah.
Yeah, and PC Engine TurboGrafx was the first game system to have a CD add-on in our CD episode, which I believe – CD-ROM history episode, which I think was episode 100 of the current run. We talked about how the fact that the first games ever published on CD were Fighting Street and some other like
Idle
anime
game.
Right? Yeah. For PC Engine Duo. Yeah. PC Engine CD-ROM 2, excuse me.
Yeah. Well, and like hearing the Redbook audio on East 1 and 2 was like a revelation. You know, you couldn't believe that music like this existed in a video game.
Yeah, we should mention that the music was streamed off the disc. The PC Engine Duo CD-ROM whatever add-on added the ability to stream pre-recorded audio or sound from the CD-ROM in addition to playing the music from the console.
Yeah, but the idea that that thing, that add-on launched for $400 with three or four games at launch was kind of insane. It completely insane. Like, in modern parlance, like, this would never happen again.
Yeah, but then they launched also a $300 handheld version of the system.
Yeah, the Turbo.
So it's like, NEC was crazy.
But it was a no-compromises handheld. It was a console that you could carry with you, not like Game Boy or Game Gear. I mean, when Game Gear came out, it was the Master System in portable form but with more colors. But that was, you know, that system was like 5 years old at that point.
It was no compromises. It was all coming from, you know, the bubble era. And it's like you ship that over to America where you have a lot of, more doting parents and things.
Feel like PC Engine CD-ROM came at least a year or two before like CD-ROM mania, like missed Seventh Guest CD-ROM mania.
PC Engine CD launched at the end of 88 and missed launch in 1993.
I guess I'm amazed that it came
it's 5 years.
That like it came into existence. That enough people in Japan were like, this is what we need to throw all this money into.
It's way, way better than, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica.
It's true. Yeah. But like I was excited about TurboGrafx CD, even though I didn't have it. But like the fact that it existed, that games like East Book 1 and 2 existed, like it did spark something in me that like, you know, the through line from East Book 1 and 2 to like Final Fantasy 7 is kind of there. The ambition of what you're trying to do with the medium.
Yeah, that's valid. I mean, for sure. I mean, they were bringing anime into a digital form essentially before that was even really a thing.
Yeah, and like Dragon Quest had changed the world and like, and let's take anime and take Dragon Quest and do something else with the ideas.
Meanwhile, in America, video stores hadn't even created their Japanimation section.
Right.
Hey, it was so far ahead of its curve. We still had like Heavy Metal Clash at Demonhead covers instead of the anime that was actually in the game.
We had to wait for Akira on VHS to build the section around
that. I mean, John Madden Football wasn't even out yet, really. Like, this was a different era.
Gosh.
Okay, so guys, how do we feel about the branding TurboGrafx 16? Where do we stand on the 16-bit thing?
It's totally in your face.
Well, but is it really 16-bit?
Right.
That's the question.
That's my question.
That's a real gotcha, I think.
It is.
The graphics processor is only 8-bit, right?
No, the CPU is 8-bit. Like I said, it's very similar to the NES processor.
Yeah, Hudson had developed their own version, much like how Nintendo did. Nintendo made their own version of that chip for the Famicom, and Hudson kind of made their own modified version for the PC Engine.
Right. But the graphics chip was 16-bit, and it offloaded a fair amount of the work from the CPU. Like, the Master System was kind of built around the same way. The Master System was actually an SG-1000, but with like super beefy graphics processor added to the dinky little SG-1000 processor. And this was kind of the same thing, except there was no like precursor. I mean, I guess you could consider it an NES basically with like a hyper-powered graphics processor.
I'd say the games did look closer to Sega Genesis games. Like at launch, for the first 2 years, like it was fairly indistinguishable.
I think TurboGrafx PC Engine is the exact middle ground visually between NES and Genesis.
They looked closer to Genesis. They played closer to NES.
Right.
That's true.
And there's way fewer effects. Like, because as a Genesis fanboy, like just the parallax, like the amount of the ease by which you could do parallax scrolling in like on Turbo, you didn't see as much of it. It was harder to pull off.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you know, the hyper-powered visual processor, graphics processor, would get even beefed up more by the Super Graphics release.
Oh God!
Which like added quadruple the power or something.
But what an ill-advised device!
Like. Well, listen. First of all, you asked us about the branding. The fact that NEC in Japan adopted the graphics,
well, and core graphics as well.
Yeah. It's so silly.
It is weird that like
the weird bad, that it was adopted back.
Yeah, the bad branding came back, and like Super Graphics, the design of that console, the chassis, is like an abomination.
And they were going to make it more of an abomination. They were planning like a steering wheel attachment and like a flight yoke thing. Like they wanted to. It didn't make it to market, but considering all the other crazy stuff NEC did.
And, you know, I think I remember listening to an episode about the PC Engine LT. Like there's all sorts of weird, like NEC clearly had no problem just like doing weird shit, which I do kind of applaud in post. Like,
Yeah, the Super Graphics is the model that I own.
That happen?
I decided, okay, when the Terra Onion Super SD System 3 came out, which allows you to play any Turbo or PC Engine game, including disc games and Super Graphics games, when that came out, I was like, you know, I really do need to add a Turbo Graphics to my library. And if I get this model, which is a little more expensive than the other models and actually less expensive than others, then I have the ability to play everything with the Terra Onion device.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, there's 6 games for the Super Graphics. It's not really.
I also own one. Mine was a gift from friend of the show Mark McDonald of 8-4. Like that was like, the greatest gift anyone's ever given me. I was like, here's a Super Graphics.
I don't quite get the industrial military design on this thing.
It's weird. It's like a rib cage.
It looks like a boss you'd fight in Xevious.
Or you're like you're shipping off to Afghanistan. You're bringing your Super Graphics as body
armor.
It's supposed
to look like an engine.
Oh, really?
Really? Oh.
It does.
So it's like spark plugs
and outside? And I'll say, okay. Like, as these things are happening in real time, those of us reading game magazines are like, what are they doing? What are all these things? Like,
I remember EGM talking a lot about Super Graphics.
Oh, yeah. Like, it was going to have the best version of Strider.
No, but it was
going to be so good.
We all knew that it was clear. Like, why would you spend like hundreds of dollars for like a thing that's only going to have a handful of games?
But I don't think anyone knew at the time that it was only going to have 6 games.
No, we did. Like, no one I know bought a Super Graphics. We all knew better.
Maybe by then, but like at the very outset of it. It's just like, wow, this is it. This is the potential.
Well, and like, you know, we're kind of Turbo throughout its life in America. By the time of Bonk's Adventure, that was where it kind of broke through. They had a mascot who was different. The gameplay was slightly different.
Exactly, and that's when they started pushing the advertising a bit more.
Yeah, there was more, you know, a lot more print ads. Maybe there was a TV commercial even? Maybe. Like, Bonk had some cultural significance. I'll give it that.
A teeny bit, yes.
I'm pretty sure I saw a TV commercial for Bonk. I saw video footage of Bonk when I was younger, and I'm pretty sure that was on TV commercials, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, I had friends who were curious about Bonk, and, like, the fact that Bonk made it to, like, Super Nintendo and
NES. They always showed Bonk, like, at his maximum size with the giant head, and they would zoom the camera in really close on him, so it looked like, wow, he fills up the whole screen, which, of course, was not true.
Right.
But that was the perception that they wanted to give you.
But, you know,
their whole advertising was a little iffy. Like, we were talking before about the Vigilante advertisement, where they were like, you could play Super Mario Brothers, or you could play Vigilante in your face!
Which takes 20 minutes. Right.
Like, but it was like comparing a 1985 NES game, you know, first generation, first wave of game releases for NES, versus like, hey, here's a 1989 vintage game.
I mean, that said, Bonk is a bit of a godsend, and clearly it's by design. And like in the era where platformers, mascots were a dime a dozen, and you had to have one when Sonic and Mario were at war, NEC did kind of rise to the occasion and make a vaguely cool mascot, although Zonk, way cooler.
Zonk,
He's a rockabilly spaceman.
Only got 2 games.
But Bonk was hot. People liked Bonk. I was there. People liked him.
Mm-hmm. I did.
And that's probably why the system was never released formally in Europe, because they were like, Bonk.
It is weird.
Should have called him Snog.
It is interesting that it was only a gray market import ever in Europe.
I mean, you know, after it kind of failed to really get a lot of traction in the U.S., Europe was always kind of the secondary market after the U.S., so the tertiary market. And I think it just didn't make sense to take
They're
it
like,
there.
We have the Konix multi-system. We don't want your legendary axe.
Yeah, we don't need the Super Graphics. We already have
We have Space Camel.
Yeah.
But I feel like Turbo Graphics would have done pretty well in Europe, because they do love shooters over there and racing games, and there were some really great shooters and racing games.
Tons of good shmups.
Yeah, like that's kind of the thing.
Well,
the system's
thing. That's actually, like, when you go back, like, the best launch game for Turbo Graphics is Blazing Lasers. It's actually really good.
Despite the excessive use of the letter Z?
Exactly. Or, you know, we haven't quite talked about Duo. I guess we should. But, like, Gate of Thunder became, like, the game to have, the killer app, like a traditional side-scrolling shmup.
Gate or Lords?
I think Gate is the winner.
Okay, yeah. Mm. Well, it also came with it, so yeah.
It's actually better, too.
Lords was never released in the U.S., right?
It was.
Oh, you know, yeah. I thought there was one of the Thunder games that did not come here.
Lords of Thunder also got a port to Sega CD. Yes. It's a different name. Yeah.
Okay, we should talk a little bit about each of the models that I could actually write down and find the existence of.
All 30 of them.
Yeah. So just to kind of clarify, because we've been throwing around names here kind of willy-nilly, I think it would help for us to kind of provide some clarity on what each of these things are. So very methodically, let's go through and talk about what is the PC engine, like as a piece of hardware. What is that?
Small, white, different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. It's the base model. It was the original 1987 release in Japan. And I kind of described it earlier. It's not much bigger than the controller that it comes with.
It's the size of a personal pan pizza.
Smaller.
But yeah, it's like if Little Caesars did a personal pan pizza, it would be square. And
I'm thinking
be
about
that.
The little ones that got a Pizza Hut as a kid. It's about that.
Right. But those are round, whereas this is like square.
True.
Like
oh,
little,
come
little
on.
Caesars.
Oh, come now.
Yes. That's the important distinction to make.
It's like Detroit style pizza, the squares. I like this pizza analogy.
Sicilian.
Yeah, sure. There we
go. All right. The PC Engine Duo.
That's not the next revision.
I'm not going necessarily chronological.
Oh, okay.
I'm going in like the order that I just wrote stuff down.
Oh, well, so that is the combination of the PC Engine and the PC Engine CD-ROM.
Yeah, so because the PC Engine was very small, in order to attach to the CD-ROM peripheral, it had to have like this connector on the back that attached it, created a bridge between the two systems.
Yeah, and the CD-ROM to ROM is like it sits next to and like the PC Engine sits on top of this larger device. Unlike in America where the topographics becomes this giant weird thing. Yeah.
They had to build this vertical toilet-shaped thing.
Yeah.
Mm, good times. Yeah, so the Duo is basically a very sleek sort of – the original model is gray.
Well, also, in order to use the PC Engine with the CD-ROM attachment, you need to have a system card. There are three different system cards, and the Duo builds that system card into the device.
Yes.
And you so the Duo can play both Who Card games and CD-ROM games.
Super CD-ROM card games.
And Super CD-ROM games, yes.
It looks like a fax machine with the lid shut.
I really like it.
No wonder Japan loves it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the Duo is very utilitarian, but it's a good thing.
There's also the PC Engine Duo R. Internally, how did that differ? Like externally, it's white as opposed to gray.
Does the Duo R have the arcade card, or is it the Duo AC?
Oh God, I don't even know offhand.
You're skipping ahead. So like ultimately, towards the end, there's a third system card which adds RAM, adds more capabilities, and there's a latest Duo, and I think that's the RX, which has the arcade card built in.
Jeez. And a six-button pad.
The cards that you used for the Super CD-ROM were really interesting, though, because they weren't just like a program saying, hey, you can run these games now. They expanded the capabilities of the system.
They did. And a fun thing is like, you know, playing a game that requires a card with the wrong system card will get you a bespoke, unique mess error message from some games. So that's like, there's a whole website which has
VG Museum has a great chronicle of those and also the Neo Geo Pocket error messages and Game Boy Color error
messages. And some of the ones on Duo are even playable, like the Dragon X when you actually quite play it.
It's like a little graffiti version of Dragon X.
You know, I'd imagine that like, you know, in Japan, the CD-ROM attachment for PC Engine seems to have been fairly popular, that a lot of people did have it. You know, whereas I think in America, until the Duo came out, it was not very widespread to have the CD attachment.
Right. Yeah. Just based on the fact that it was the third stringer and an expensive peripheral.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Well, and also the TurboGrafx was so big, like because of the expanded casing on it, that when you added that peripheral, it became really unwieldy.
The CD-ROM attachment for the TurboGrafx was massive. And even more so, it came with this super huge hard carrying case. Yeah. The box for the TurboGrafx CD was like you could live inside of it.
Yeah.
It was the biggest
box.
It
was like the USS Flag of video games.
Yeah.
Nice of them to include it.
It's true.
They carried over that briefcase metaphor from the PC Engine, but went a bit too far with it.
So we also mentioned the Super Graphics before, but that's a system that's really hard to explain.
Dude, it died on the vine. It had like six games.
Right, well, but like visually, it's hard to describe. It's such a weird-looking system.
Gunmetal gray looks like a base, like a military base or something. Like
I think you guys described, someone said it earlier, it does look kind of like a robot's rib cage. But I think they were trying to go for an engine motif.
Yeah. Well, and
engine block.
Around the same time, the shuttle graphics, the Core Graphics 2, and the Super Graphics all launched.
Right. So let's talk about the PC Engine Shuttle.
Yes.
No one's ever explained to me why it exists.
I don't even know what this is.
I think it's the low cost model. I've seen it in person.
In Japan.
You look at the box art for it and it's all like this cartoon family sort of illustration of it. So it is sort of meant to be like a low cost, low function sort of version for kids and families.
You can't expand it.
No, you cannot expand it.
And it's weirdly shaped.
It's a Roomba.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
like
a pre-Roomba.
It looks like something you'd like throw as like a flying disc or something.
It's a little bit
like a manta ray almost.
Well, again, it's supposed to be a shuttle shape, and then the controller also has like a special sort of spaceshipy kind of look to it. And
why? It's like the Star Wars land speeder
kind
of.
NEC thought they could just throw money at it.
Kids gear, I kind of get it. This thing, no.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when you already had,
I guess it's kind of like the Pikachu N64.
Oh, yes. That's a good one. Yeah, that's a good analogy.
I still regret not buying the Spice Orange Pikachu N64.
Yeah, me too.
There was a Spice Orange one?
Only in Japan.
Yeah, that's hot. Yeah.
I know. I had it in my hands. Missed opportunities.
The Core Graphics. That's basically
It's just a remake of the PC Engine with black.
Yeah.
It's stylish.
And then the Core Graphics, too. Like, what even is that?
Well, the key thing is that they added composite output.
Right.
So the original PC Engine. Yeah, was RF only.
Yep. Got it. Let's see. Also in Japan, the Pioneer Laser Active.
Oh, God. Mm. Where's Chris Kohler when you need him?
Well, of course, this dovetails into the Mega Drive as well.
I'll say the Laser Active was like, you know, just when you thought, could this weird thing that's only for rich motherfuckers get any crazier and weirder? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Pioneer's like, oh, hold my beer.
Yeah.
There has to have been a full Laser Active episode of Retronauts, no?
I don't know that it really supports an episode.
I could try.
How much would it cost for me to pay for Chris Kohler to talk about that for like 3 hours?
Yeah, we got Patreon. Let's go.
Yeah. So the Laser Active was a Laserdisc player that also played video games. And I think
if you bought modules.
Yeah, you could buy modules for both the Sega Genesis and the TurboGrafx.
Yeah. And which also supported a extra Laserdisc-based format for those systems that you could only get on that system. So
and
you had the PC Engine LD and Mega LD.
Yeah, which had unique games like Pyramid Patrol.
Of course.
But yeah, like the number of people who had all this is like single digits.
Exactly.
The Sharp X1 Twin.
Which one is that?
Is it
the TV that has a built-in PC Engine?
Close. That's another one. Oh. This is the PC with the PC Engine built-in.
Oh, shit.
So it's a Sharp X1 PC.
It's like, watch out, Terra Drive.
It is the Terra Drive version of the PC Engine.
Yeah, it's not. Like, based on the title, I thought it was going to be like the Sharp Twin Famicom, which is just like a really funky NES plus
disc. Does this have anything unique for it?
No. It's just a slot, basically, on a PC.
Oh.
It's really weird because NEC and Sharp were competitors, and yet here is a Sharp computer, which is kind of cutting into NEC's business, and it has the NEC Hudson console built into it.
So many things about the bubble era are hard to explain. That's one of them.
I always thought that both NEC and Sega signed up with Pioneer for Laser Active was kind of weird. So.
Yeah. The Pioneer wasn't making PCs.
So what was this TV with the TurboGrafx built into it?
That was just an NEC monitor
with
a PC Engine slot.
Oh.
And, you know, you could play RGB quality PC Engine on it.
That's appealing.
There was a TV for Super Famicom like that, too.
Oh, yeah.
There was.
Super Famicom.
Yeah.
But this is a PC monitor. So think of that Sharp computer, but this time you could use this monitor on your NEC PC, but also play PC Engine games on it.
All right. Then over on America's side, there was the TurboGrafx 16, which we've talked about. It was big and cumbersome.
And like, I'd like to be in the meeting where they decided, yes, let's put it in this giant empty chassis for no reason.
I feel like it was the same marketing meeting that caused the Atari Lynx to turn out the way it did.
It's kind of similar. Yeah, like Lynx and this have kind of a similar visual aesthetic to me.
I always heard some conjecture that it was due to like, you know, an FCC thing, like they were trying to protect those RF waves from getting out or something, so they had to make it bigger. I don't know, but that's what I heard a long time ago.
Also, like the part of the TurboGrafx that always baffled me, and then I never had one. I have an original TurboGrafx 16, but I never bought the like optional Turbo Bank thing.
Turbo
Booster?
So there was the Turbo Booster that added composite output, and then the Turbo Booster Plus, which added the memory expansion to it, so you could save games on
Which is weird. That's weird.
Yeah.
That's real weird.
And then, but if you get the CD-ROM, it doesn't matter because it has all that built in.
So. Yeah.
I think it's the first box, or maybe the only game console box to have lifestyle advertising on the front where it's just like a smiling
a dude.
Zach Morris face, which is not present on the Mini. Mm-hmm. I say bring him back. Find that man. Photograph him today.
Yeah, they retired him.
that was the visual identity of the launch branding of print ads and stuff. It was like this, like, you know, like kind of weird newsprint dude.
Yeah. But he's not even holding a controller. It's just like the side of his head smiling at something off screen. It's weird. But it's half the box.
Yeah. It's like clip art.
Yeah, it's very funny.
I do think the logo, the Tower 16 logo is kind of good. And the PC Engine logo is great.
Yeah, they're both pretty good. Yeah. Solid. They both have a presence to them.
It's in the shape of the Hue. Is it Hue card or Hue card?
Card. Dealer's choice.
Hue card.
Sure. The Turbo Duo, how is that different than the PC Engine Duo besides the region thing?
It's a different color.
Yeah, I don't think it's that different. But the thing about also, well, between the TurboGrafx and PC Engine, they changed the size of the controller connectors.
From huge to small.
Or, yeah, the other way around. I don't know.
But, they started big, got like half the size. Yeah.
So not only did you only have a system that could only have one controller slot.
Yeah, the fact that Turbo had one controller slot and you had to buy the Turbo Tap to get a 5-player adapter. Yeah.
To get two.
At
least, yeah. You had also had this size differential thing that they
also had. In Japan, the cord of the PC Engine controller is, I shit you not, like 15 centimeters long.
Yeah,
it is like
super
the shortest cord mankind has ever seen.
I think one thing we missed here is that the name TurboGrafx comes from the fact that it has turbo built into the controller as a feature. We didn't even say that.
Which is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that was a really cool idea.
Yeah, like you could turn it up, turn it on.
And yet another fun fact, when the PC Engine very first came out, it did not have turbo switches on it.
I was going to ask about that.
They revised it later.
Okay.
Huh. In Japan, yeah.
Interesting.
So you can get that rare
also,
switchless version.
Also, those of us who remembered like the weird like joypad for NES that had the turbo, that was Hudson's one. And it was kind of like a like a presage of what was going to happen.
Yeah, that was Hudson's thing. They had the Joy Card controller for Famicom with the turbo switches. They pretty much originated that, and then everybody sort of ripped them off. And
they were like, you too can press buttons as quickly as Takahashi Meiji.
That was the point.
Yeah. I was in love with the idea of a slow-mo feature until I realized it was turbo pause and didn't work with every game.
Not so great. Okay, let's bring it home. Talk about the Turbo Express, a.k.a. the PC Engine GT.
This is, I always wanted one of these.
It was a Cadillac of portable consoles.
It was a portable PC Engine.
Yeah, in the era of Game
Boy. Played the cards.
In the era of original Game Boy, Lynx, and Game Gear, this thing was a literal just reproduction of the home console that played the same games with a TV tuner. It was very expensive.
I really like the Turbo Express mode built into the Mini. Have you seen it yet?
Yeah.
Yes.
It has like that really bad screen filter that you can turn on or off. So you can get the very accurate, like, I cannot see what's happening effect.
As someone who always wanted a Turbo Express, and, you know, I don't mean to be hyperbolic, but I think the PC Engine GT filter on the PC Engine Mini is the greatest innovation in human history.
And it was always advertised.
I really love it. It's such a great detail. Yeah.
This was always advertised playing a football game.
Yeah.
Not a video game, but like a TV. Sports game.
Yeah. Oh, did it have a TV tuner?
Like TV tuner was optional. So I got my Turbo Express years later, like after I got my Turbo Graphics 16, and it was great. Rest in peace. Like the screen got broken while moving out to California, but like when I first finally got it, having never touched one because nobody had it because it was so expensive, it is so much fatter. Yeah. Like you think a Game Boy OG is fat? When you pick this thing up, it is like holding a bunch of bananas. It is huge.
You look at it from the front and you think, oh, it's probably like a little wide and then kind of thin. But no, it's like a circle. It's like a square.
It's like 6 inches wide. Yeah,
it's like a Game Boy. The Game Boy that's been on Mars in Total Recall.
But the screen is very bright. It looks really good.
I mean, there were portable black and white little handheld TVs at the time, right? But the idea of a portable color screen was the future. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, because those were like little tubes, the black and white ones. And this was an LCD.
You could buy a Sony Watchman. But
it feels like an old Watchman. Like all the buttons are really big and analog on it. It's a neat device.
Yeah. And then finally, you said the PC Engine GT, the Turbo Express, was the Cadillac. But no, the Cadillac is the PC Engine LT, which
like
is
a laptop.
It is. LT means laptop. It folds over like a DS. It can plug into a CD-ROM.
Yeah, you have
a portable system that can like plug into a TV and a CD-ROM and stick a controller in it. It is basically a portable console.
Wasn't like the MSRP like $1,100 or something?
It was pretty expensive. Yeah. That's definitely what it sells for now.
Yeah.
I wish I had bought one back when it was merely $500 because that would have been apparently a steal. compared to what it's.
But yeah, like few consoles have had such weird mutants. Just it's an interesting lineup. You gotta say.
Yeah, it was basically like a PC engine for all seasons. Whatever your needs, whatever your desires, there was one that could meet them, and that is pretty unique. I mean, some of the choices they made were poor, like the super graphics. Like that is some straight up Sega 32X kind of nonsense. Yeah. Like, let's fragment the market. But fortunately, it did not have lasting impact on people's trust.
And the least we
32X
the did. Less we say about the PCFX, the better, probably.
Yeah, I mean, that's not even the same system. Right. That is the weird follow up.
But you know, looking back now, the software lineup, I still feel like in America and in Japan, it's a very different perspective. Because if I think back about the TurboGrafx Duo lineup in America. You know, it's neat, it's weird, it's quirky, it's lots of arcade ports, lots of Japanese games. Obviously, a few very strange things made for America, which if you think about those, yes. Like that's like a whole episode of Retronauts right there. But in general, I think most of the lineup was left in Japan. And like my first like 10 trips to Japan, the old days of Akihabara, you would go to the PC Engine section, there's hundreds of games you've never heard of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tons and tons of anime licensed things that never, ever, 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 ever came to America.
Yeah. I want to talk about the US versus Japan of the TurboGrafx and also the software library. But first, we're going to take a break. So one thing we haven't really talked about that much is what the CD-ROM did for the platform beyond, you know, just adding some streaming audio, because it did augment the capabilities of the system somewhat. I mean, I think the biggest innovation, the biggest improvement it brought was the fact that it could store like 500 times the memory of a HU card.
Right.
That was kind of a big deal. Like, but it was actually more space than most people could make use of effectively. But
right. But how many games did anything with it besides music?
Well, there were also, like, you know, anime-style cutscenes.
Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective.
Right. No, just the constraints of cartridges were a really big deal at the time, and it forced a lot of games to be scaled down from what they were originally envisioned as.
I mean, when you say anime-style cutscenes, quick, like, record scratch. I mean, like, in reality.
I said style.
Yeah. I had in my mind what I thought they were going to be, having not seen them until, like, a few years later, right? And, like, having seen Lunar the Silver Star before I ever saw East Book 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. I will say I was disappointed by what I got out of PC Engine TurboGrafx cutscenes on CD-ROM. There were not as many frames of animation. Like something like Cosmic Fantasy 2 has a few decent ones, but usually it was like a small window. It was like at best like a fourth of the screen showing you a cutscene.
Yeah, I mean, true. I think all that unique art still took up a lot of space, though, that could, overpower a HU card or a cartridge or whatever.
Yeah, just, those would not have been possible on a cartridge.
Like, a anime girl's face moving at all was like a revelation. You'd never seen that on a cartridge before, really. But I think the reality of what a TurboGrafx CD-ROM gave you from a visual perspective was a little disappointing.
I still think it was pretty advanced and, you know, like I said, kind of a harbinger of where things were going. Because, I mean, they tried. You can't say they didn't try.
The problem was at the same time, like, Wing Commander was happening, right? So, like, if you had a PC, if you had access to a real PC, an x86 PC, it was a little disappointing to see what it was doing for me.
I mean, what year was Wing Commander with CD-ROM?
1990-ish?
Yeah, but I mean, this system came out in 88. So like it really was way ahead of everyone
else.
Like
a game like Loom, ironically. Like, you know, like this kind of like the level of like graphical cutscene intensity artistry was, you know, it wasn't only in Japan on PC and CD. It was happening in Europe. It was happening in America on PC.
I think Loom was on par with what was happening in PC Engine games.
Loom actually CD-ROM came out for PC.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm.
It's a little bit apples and oranges.
I find it hard to come down too much on.
Well, but imagine you just spent $400, right? That's the thing. It's like if you just spent $400 for the add-on
for
your game.
Spent $400 and you didn't know what anime was before you just saw it in the digital bitmap form. Then yeah, I can see how maybe that would let you down.
Right, but this was spending $400 on top of $200 at a time when $400 was like $1,000.
But if you were coming from NES cartridges or even just Sega Genesis cartridges, it still felt like a big step forward.
I would argue that maybe it wasn't actually. Like, that was the thing. Like, I didn't feel guilty or bad about not buying it, not having it. Even though, like, it was existing, I felt like, well, actually, for not spending $400, Phantasy Star 2 ending looks really good, you know?
Like, yeah, but you can't tell me that the intro to Rondo of Blood could have been done on a game,
well,
like,
and
a
you're
cartridge
right.
system.
Okay, like, I guess if you're going to cut, if you're going to fast forward to what is the greatest game for PC Engine, yes, Dracula X Rondo of Blood is.
It's not the only game that has good animation.
Chef's kiss. Also very late game.
93. I don't know.
That's late.
I guess.
PlayStation's almost out.
Yeah, that's.
Yeah, I feel like you kind of keep jumping between, like, the Japanese and American market. Like, you're talking about PlayStation was almost out in Japan. It was still like 2 years away in America.
Because you're right. TurboGrafx market starts later here and ends earlier here.
Exactly.
Yeah, and doesn't really have too many hardcore people who are like sad to
and
see
it why, go. And that's why the system fared poorly and why, you know, you have to kind of put an asterisk next to a discussion of TurboGrafx-16 because it was like it came 2 years later than the PC Engine and that had a huge impact on its performance here.
Yeah.
Right. By the time Sega CD had launched, you know, then there was a direct competitor who you could kind of like evenly compare it to. Sega CD seemed better? Question mark? To me, at least?
Yeah, big question mark.
No one else agrees there? No.
Well, I mean, they leaned more on the video stuff than, say, the TurboGrafx had the anime stuff. So in terms of like appealing to an American audience that is a bunch of white guys, you know, maybe they would want the video.
I did find it interesting that Sega CD pack-in was one of them was Sherlock Holmes, which had been a TurboGrafx game.
Right, yes, which Johnny Turbo told us.
Johnny Turbo. Okay, talk about Johnny Turbo.
I mean, I barely even know what Johnny Turbo is outside of now he's back, baby.
He is back.
Yeah.
Well, so it's a weird marketing pitch ploy, something. I don't know.
It looks like it's making fun of marketing. I don't understand.
It was meta-ish.
It's hard to tell. It's honestly hard to tell. To me, it's just very
kind
of
opaque. It was a series of comic strips, basically.
Based
comic
on
panels,
a real person.
Pages. Yeah, based on a guy named Jonathan Brandstetter who worked at TTI, Turbo Technologies Incorporated, which we haven't even talked about yet. But yeah, basically the marketing department built like this comic book style single page adventures around him, calling him Johnny Turbo. He was like a superhero who was trying to save kids from the evil corporate goons, the soulless robots of the Feca Corporation, which was
Feca.
Clearly supposed to... Oh, Feca!
Feca.
A
thinly veiled
yes. There we go.
Sega.
Yeah.
Weirdly, completely like never mentioning Nintendo ever in these ads.
Nintendo, yeah, didn't really get mentioned much, but I think that's because TurboGrafx and Genesis were much more kind of rivals at the time, since
sure
they launched basically at the same time. Super NES wouldn't come until 2 years later.
Sure, given the chance, Johnny Turbo would scream, but Nintendo doesn't even have a CD-ROM.
Well, and this was an ongoing series of ads. And I remember at the point at which the Feca Corporation was about to launch the Feca CD, that's when Johnny got real mad.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Nintendo's a much easier name to pun, to make fun of. I remember all the ones from like Mad Magazine, like No Friendo, Numbindo.
Yes.
Very, like, go nuts with that. Sega, much harder.
But I remember at the time thinking Johnny Turbo seemed kind of desperate and sad, and he wasn't very, like, you know, aspirational.
Yeah, he wasn't very superheroic.
Yeah, that's why it's hard to tell if it was meta or not. Because it's
like, I'd imagine he looked kind of like he really looked.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I've met the actual Johnny Turbo, and he looks pretty much like, you know, an older version of the guy in that comic.
He was on the Computer Chronicles. You can find him in an episode of that.
I don't think those ads worked. I don't think anything really worked for TurboGrafx for a TTI until, like, they had the $99 bundle where you got the TurboGrafx with Bonk and another game. I mean, or, like, when Duo was getting, like, clearanced out for,
Americans
like, $80.
Very easily influenced by low prices.
Was Johnny Turbo their Takahashi Meijin? They're like, we need one of those schlubby guys on our side.
I don't know.
I mean, it was like a bad version of that. Yeah.
I like my theory.
Yeah, it is.
But,
it's
you know, Master Takahashi was kind of a big deal because he
had a skill.
Yeah. He was marketable, like a marketable
but
skill.
But also, like, Johnny Turbo only showed up in like 3 print ads. Comic print ads.
And there was no Johnny Turbo game. They should have made Keith Courage, Johnny Turbo, and Alpha Zones.
Not back then, but no.
Well, now he's back with Johnny Turbo's Arcade for Nintendo Switch, which is Data East arcade games, not TurboGrafx games.
One of those games have come out for PS4.
Oh, has it?
One of them.
I would say, though, that, you know, before the Johnny Turbo, like, the TurboGrafx print ads were not bad. I've been looking at them, and they were kind of stylish, and they did sort of communicate a certain coolness about the system. But
they,
once
they
things
had a little
switched
bit of a
over
punk
to
rock
TTI,
Z aesthetic to
yeah,
them.
They kind of fell apart a bit. So, I mean, and, you know, to say nothing of the terrible box art. But.
We should probably explain what TTI is. Is someone else capable of doing that? Because it gives me a headache.
So really quickly.
Before TTI.
So it was NEC Technologies Incorporated was responsible for marketing the TurboGrafx in America. Then they gave more leeway to Hudson because Hudson, who in the U.S. was basically all Nintendo for many years, had finally started to move over to publish more of their own stuff on TurboGrafx. So NEC kind of split off that division for TurboGrafx and joined up with Hudson to make Turbo Technologies Incorporated, which would then be responsible for marketing the rest of the TurboGrafx plus the Turbo Duo.
It was that by the time Duo had come out,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. It was basically purposed for the Duo to bring that up and get people interested in it.
Okay. And then TTI continued to sell the TurboGrafx well into the late 90s. After a while, they just went online.
Yes and no. So they gave all – once they shut that down, all the old stock went to TurboZone Direct.
Okay.
Which but was like, a mail-order company.
Towards the tail end of Duo, like a few games got like canceled. I mean, it was like a trickle of games
right
at the end. And then, yeah, it went into kind of like legacy mode.
Yeah.
Mail order only.
Yeah.
Yeah.
TZD.
TurboZone Direct. Maybe I'm getting that mixed up. And I just remember having the opportunity to buy PC Engine games, TurboGrafx games, online in like 1999. Thinking,
Also, the speed from which like turning the page again, Airzonk's coming out, it all seems cool again to it's all over was like a year. Like
it was pretty quick, yeah.
Right. And like, I think a lot of people started to pay attention at the end because like, you know, it was 1993 and things were changing, but like it was too late.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have John Madden Duo CD Football.
Right. Like yeah, and some of the games towards the end, like I always point to like Addams Family. Like I think there was like a bespoke, unique Addams Family CD-ROM game where you play as Dan Hedaya from the movie.
Yeah.
Like how did these things happen?
There's an original Tailspin game, an original Darkwing Duck game, not made by Capcom, just for TurboGrafx.
Or like in Japan, Street Fighter fucking 2. Like crazy things kind of happened at the end of this console, actually.
But we didn't see that here. In Japan, they received about 670 games total for the TurboGrafx or the PC Engine, the PC Engine CD-ROM 2, and the Super Graphics.
Hence, to bring it back, like, yeah, we were going to Japan.
600
Going to Japan, seeing the PC Engine section, being overwhelmed. Being like, what the hell?
It is overwhelming.
That's about half the Famicom library. So, yeah. Not bad, not bad.
JJ and Jeff was a lie.
No, it was Kato and Kinchan, thank you.
You know, that's a pretty good game. People pooped on it, but it's a fun game.
But it's because they didn't need to.
Pooping was built in
the game.
That's right. By comparison to those 670 games, America got about 125, 130.
That's still more than I would have thought. Yeah.
A handful of which were unique to the U.S., most of which were just localized games. What were some of the unique U.S. releases?
Like Falcon 3.0, which had unique... I learned on Retronauts, if you played that on Turbo Expresses, it had like a unique point of view for Versus with a link cable.
Oh, goodness. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yep. Wow. Yeah. There's Impossible.
It's Impossible?
I had Impossible.
There's like a CinemaWare. Like, it came from the desert, and there's also...
CinemaWare was like a big backer.
There's like two or three CinemaWare games.
Yeah, they made the TV sports games.
Yeah. There's Beyond Shadowgate. There's all sorts of weird.
Beyond Shadowgate was one of the very final games, right? Like at the it's late 1993.
Has good animation.
So yeah, with CinemaWare and ICOM Simulations were like the two big Western backers for the TurboGrafx / Duo, and they released stuff like Impossible and things, and also
the Disney license games are weird.
Those and things like the Beach Boys saga.
Right.
Wait, what?
Yo
Bro and Camp California.
Yep. Which are kind of good.
Based on failed attempts. What are these games?
Addams Family. These are all NEC. Like
The Beach Boys.
Oh, they're like side scrolling. You're a bear.
Yeah, they're cartoony.
You're cleaning up the beach.
They're supposed to be like a cartoon franchise based on the Beach Boys, but did not actually.
Like the band, the Beach Boys.
I'd say
you're a cartoon bear.
I'd say it's the Green Dog equivalent for.
Ooh, Green Dog. I remember seeing that on. They were aggressively marketing the TurboGrafx 16 and Turbo Duo. I think on VHS tapes they would send out to you. And for some reason, I got three of the same tape in the mail, and I would watch it over and over.
Can I have one? I'm jealous.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I still have them, but there was a very strange narrator, and you would see clips of all the games and all of the showy, offy full-motion video stuff, and that Beach Boys thing was on that video, I'm pretty sure.
There's another video with like just like people dressed in the turquoise and neon TurboGrafx apparel and just dancing around and holding Yahoo cards. It's crazy.
I didn't get that one.
No. And Tony Hawk edited one of those.
Wow. but it is like, you know, 95% Japanese content. Mm. It really is. And I remember even at launch being like, what's a Chu Man Fu? Like, what are these games?
More Chinese than Japanese. Well, the thing is that originally PC Engine was bolstered by its quality of arcade ports. And it had a lot of support from like Namco and Capcom, and in some cases Sega, licensed-wise, who were, you know, Namco really had a lot of good arcade ports because, you know, the contemporary arcade games of the time, you know, there was not as much 3D stuff being tossed around. Right. So a lot of it was a lot of 16-bit platformers and so on, things that could be translated a lot better to the PC Engine. Yeah. And you can actually learn some of this in High Score Girl if you want to watch that. Mm. But, like, you can get the gist of that is that, yeah, the PC Engine was really early on helped by a lot of good arcade ports, but you bring that over to America and people are like, what the hell is Ordyne?
Right.
Or Wonder Momo. Really, we didn't even get that.
Right, yeah. None of that really tracks.
So High Score Girl is underrated.
I can see the need maybe for NEC to sort of, you know, pick and choose and maybe get more original support.
Well, I remember the first thing I imported was the Hue card of Salamander, which I'm a huge Life Force fan. And like, and I realized, Konami made a lot of really good games.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, it's not just Dracula X. Konami was a really big supporter of it as well.
I think it's important to kind of understand the context of the times in which the PC Engine launched in Japan. 1987 was the point at which Nintendo's Famicom really dominated the market, but it was starting to show its age. And so when you saw arcade conversions, 1987 was when arcade conversions started to really diverge from what you saw in the arcade. So you saw games like Section Z from Capcom or Trojan that looked like one way in the arcade. And they were obviously less graphically impressive, or Rygar from Tecmo.
Yeah.
They looked really impressive in the arcade, but they were like very shallow kind of action. And when they came to NES, the visuals obviously had to be scaled back. And so to compensate, a lot of developers would rework the gameplay so it was more suited to a console environment, which was great for those of us who played home games. But for those of us who wanted, you know, very faithful arcade conversions, it was a big letdown. Like, you know, maybe you wanted to play a Rygar game that was 36 levels of just hitting things while running in a straight line, as opposed to a backtracking kind of exploratory game with top-down views and strange boss battles and power-up systems, or Section Z where you had to like find your way through a space maze instead of just going straight forward, then up, then straight forward, then down, then straight forward, and you got to the end. So in that context, I think the PC Engine was very compelling for people who really wanted the arcade experience at home, because what the PC Engine offered was much more convincing, you know, on a visual level. And as a result, they didn't have to completely rework the games so that they had some compelling reason to play them, as opposed to just like, well, here's a really crappy, ugly version of a game that's also very shallow.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at, too.
I was just thinking about how strange it was that the launch titles for the TurboGrafx CD-ROM were Fighting Street, a.k.a. Street Fighter 1, and Wonder Boy 3 Monster Lair. And then to bring it back to our friend Christian, he was like, Monster Lair is like the best game. He like made me sit down.
That's the shooter, right?
It is. And I remember he brought his, before I ever had one, he brought his like to Kentucky where I lived and like made me play through Monster Lair with him to like sell me on TurboGrafx? That happened.
Yeah. It's a hard pitch.
Well, and like think of like this pastel colored like cute shmup was like a killer app. Strange days. Hmm. Yeah.
All right, so I do kind of want to go quickly to wrap this up through the kind of comparative libraries. Like, what are U.S. games that you guys would recommend to people? I put together a list, which like my suggestions, like but I'm not the insightful. You know, well, games released in the U.S. Hmm. If you want to just own a TurboGrafx and you don't want to deal with imports,
right? Because go try to find Cotton or Magical Chase.
Yeah. Was Magical Chase released here?
Yes. Yeah. Magical Chase from Quest.
I bet that's like thousands of dollars.
Oh, a thousand.
Mm. Absolutely.
A mint copy? Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
This is a basic choice, and we did a whole Bonk episode, but I will say Bonk's Revenge is the best Bonk game, and it's on par with like some of the best B-tier 16-bit platformers out there. It's very solidly made. It's very concise. It's very gorgeous, lots of personality, none of the flaws the other games have. I don't like Adventure. 3 is kind of mediocre, and the series just kind of falls off the cliff after that. But Bonk's Revenge, super good. It's where the series works.
You're right. Yeah. I think Arizonk.
Yeah. Oh, Arizonk.
I think Arizonk Card. Yeah. Arizonk for Card is fantastic. Arizonk CD not nearly as good.
That's true. Oh, and the Arizonk soundtrack. I don't know how they did it on that platform, but it's the best sounding soundtrack on the TG-16. That's not a CD soundtrack.
Yeah, and we didn't really talk about the hardware, but like the sound chip, nothing special.
It's kind of that shamisen synth. Yeah, it's a bit twangy, but I like it.
It is interesting the games that are stuck forever, like only on HuCard. Like I'm looking at this list, like Alien Crush and Devil's Crush, still like among the best in class. Video game pinball games ever made. Like spectacular games. Dungeon Explorer 1, really good. Really kind of ahead of its time. Great game. Galaga 90, which I brought back earlier, is like still like, you know, at that time that never had been anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Don't forget R-Type and quote-unquote R-Type 2.
Part 2, not R-Type 2.
You know, we didn't get, those of us who had Nintendo systems did not get R-Type on NES, even though Nintendo distributed R-Type in arcades in America. We had to look on at our friends with Master Systems and Envy, but then they had to look on at their friends with TurboGrafx and Envy, except, you know, again, getting to the point of these cards being constrained for capacity, the game's 8 levels were split across 2 cards. So there was the first 4 stages, and then there was part 2, the second 2 set of stages. And when this game came to Virtual Console, they actually combined them into one release.
Combined in America.
Was it?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're talking about only in America.
In America, it was on one card.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
I misunderstood.
It was. Okay. R-Type Complete.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Awesome. Well, never mind then. Forget I said
anything. So we were always winning.
All right. Yeah. Way to go, us.
The Legendary Axe, another, you know, early great side-scrolling game.
How is that different than Golden Axe?
It's very different. It's more of like...
Yeah. It's made by the guys who made Hestian Axe.
Yeah. Oh, okay. It is. And it's more like a Ninja Gaiden-style game than a belt scroller.
Yeah. It's not quite a brawler.
I would also like, you didn't listen here, but like Tiger Road was an arcade game from Capcom I really liked that weirdly was stuck on TurboGrafx for whatever reason.
The associated Sunsun 2.
Yeah, Sunsun 2.
Yeah, Sunsun 2 is interesting because that was a console-only sequel to an early Capcom arcade game.
Yeah, and not really made by Capcom. It was made by NEC Avenue, but licensed by Capcom.
Military Madness wasn't my jam because like I was on the Arizonk's Y team, but like it is well regarded. It's like, you know, like a strategy game early on. It was kind of an interesting thing. And these are all chip cards before we even get to the CD era.
Right, yeah.
And like, you know, Gate of Thunder, I kind of mentioned that earlier, one of the best side-scrolling shooters of the era and has a great hard rock, butt rock soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Obviously, East Book 1 and 2. East 3, although the version for TurboGrafx is actually kind of the worst, even though it has great music and great cutscenes. Like, it doesn't scroll correctly.
Where do we stand on Utopia 1 and 2? I've always wanted to play those. I've just never gotten around to
them. Yeah, I keep buying them on Virtual Console whenever they pop up, but I can't get around to playing
them. It's the TurboGrafx Zelda, but not as good at all.
Yeah.
Well, they are made by Hudson, and I think, you know, Hudson always made generally good games on that platform, so they're not, like, super terrible. But, you know, as far as Zelda clones are okay, I mean, but you could always play Zelda as well. Or even Crusader of Senti.
Not much charisma, yeah. Whereas Crusader of Senti has a lot of, like, charm to
exactly,
it.
Exactly, exactly.
Newtopia is really charmless.
Newtopia is just like, yeah, bare minimum.
I think another one to bring up for Turbo, which was unique and kind of a big deal at the time, was Splatterhouse. Like, yes. Splatterhouse was stuck on Turbo. It was a thing that, like, seemed really cool that everybody wished was on other platforms. And then, like, when Splatterhouse 2 and 3 came to Genesis, I was like, thank you.
But those weren't the original.
No. So, and Splatterhouse 1 was, like, a thing that, like, I remember having FOMO on that. Like, I wish I could have had that when it came out.
That was another – yeah, they pushed that one.
But it's actually not that great of a game.
It's not, but at the time, it definitely had – it made an impression. It was like, wow, look how gory and gruesome it is. Video gaming can do that? Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, if you were – a certain kid who was a gorehound, maybe. He graduated from Castlevania and played Splatterhouse.
For me, the game I really wanted to play always that did kind of live up to my expectation, more so than Eastbrook 1 and 2, was Valis. Like, so Valis 2 was early, and then Valis 3 came out simultaneously for Genesis and PC Engine here. So, but, you know, Valis 2 looked like the thing I wanted. Like, cute anime girl, fighting demon, side-scrolling action game.
That was Wolf Team, right?
It is, yeah.
We need a Wolf Team episode.
We should do a full on Wolf Team episode. And, like, by the time I played Valis 2, it wasn't the greatest gameplay I'd ever played, but the music, the sound, the story, the presentation, it definitely hit what I was looking for. And I am kind of a Valis apologist. Like, I think Valis 3 for Genesis Mega Drive is actually the best Valis, but I do like Valis 2, Valis 3, Valis 4, and Valis 1 Remake, which is only on PC.
Where do you stand on Cid of Valis?
Oh, I love SD Valis. Delightful.
All right. How about the Bomberman games, Bomberman and Bomberman 93?
And 94.
Did that come to the U.S. also?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, sorry. I didn't think so. I was just going through U.S. games here.
You're right. I just remembered. But 94 is the best. That's the sad
part. Is Bomberman on TurboGrafx just the original Bomberman, the single-player game?
Well, it's like a remake-ish reboot thing. Yeah, it's very basic. 93 did release here, and that is also, of course, much better. That's fine. But then they did release a 94 for Virtual Console over here. So.
Yeah, and a lot of kind of the legacy of PC Engine finally did make it to the U.S. on Virtual Console. And I think it was largely overlooked. And some of those games are appearing on the Mini, so hopefully they'll find a little more of an appreciative audience.
Was it the Wii U where there's like a final dump of all the the contract
was
expiring?
About at the games that weren't even localized?
I forgot that it was Wii, if it was Wii or Wii U.
Yeah, it was Wii U.
So one
it was like last year. It's not very long ago.
Pretty recent, yeah. Well, one game I think that gets overlooked, I played a ton of it in the early 2000s on the Magic Engine emulator, is the Super Dodgeball port for TG16.
Okay.
It's like the best version of that NES game.
It's like Kunio-kun.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like that, but with no flicker.
But and better graphics.
Yeah, yeah. It's so good. It's very, very good.
Yeah, they did that with the soccer game as well. I believe there's also a CD remake of River City Ransom, something like that. Yeah. So there were some Kunio games on there.
I think
pretty
for
good.
America, it's important to talk about Working Designs. It was where they got their start.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I remember being aware of them and being like, oh, you know, because they bought ads. They specifically were their first releases were Parasol Stars and Kadash, which were two games that I was interested in because I liked Bubble Bobble and I loved Kadash in the arcade. And I still think that Kadash for Turbo 16 is fantastic. It's the best version of Kadash. It's better than the Genesis one. And that version of Parasol Stars is quite good as well. But then they followed that up with a bunch of RPGs, Cosmic Fantasy, Exile.
They jumped over to disc.
Yeah, they jumped over to CD, CD-ROM. Cosmic Fantasy 2, Exile 1 and 2.
Didn't they break Exile 2 by
they
adjusting
made
it so,
Exile
so hard you can't play
incredibly
it?
Fucking impossible.
They broke a lot of things.
They broke a lot of things, but like I definitely, you know, I remember by the time I got my Turbo, like I was buying all those games directly from Working Designs because they were still selling them, and I have those all in the boxes, and like it was, you know, that was an early boutique publisher that seemed to have what I was interested in, and like they definitely brought that over to Sega CD.
Weeaboo games and bad jokes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm right there with you. What was Exile? That was like an action RPG.
It's also Wolf Team has kind of like a weird like desert Middle Eastern vibe. The first one's actually pretty good.
You could like swap characters, right?
Yeah, the battles are weird action-y, kind of sort of million-y battles. All these games are flawed but interesting, but not like super memorable.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some others on here. A lot of shooters. Gate of Thunder, which was top-down shooter, right?
Side-scroller.
Okay.
Same with
Lords.
With
a sweet-ass soundtrack.
Sweet soundtrack. Lords, also side-scrolling, kind of spiritual successor, but different. Superstar Soldier, great top-down.
All the Soldier games, yeah.
Blazing
all
Lasers.
Soldier Blade.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of compile shooters, so I don't like Blazing Lasers that much, but all the Soldier games
if
are
you
good.
Speak ill against Musha, it is war between
I'm
us.
Sorry.
Take it outside, guys. Super Air Zonk, we've mentioned. Cotton, we kind of touched on in passing, but
super rare.
I can't believe that and Magical Chase were released here. Yeah. They're so not American.
Cotton is a CD, Magical Chase is a chip. And Magical Chase is a side-scrolling witch shooter by the guy who made Ogre Battle?
Yeah. Well, kind of by the guy. I mean, it's by the same studio. I don't know that he was like...
Same room. Somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere. And then Cotton is you're also a witch, but you're in search of candy, and you have a little bikini fairy who flies around with you and scolds you for eating too much candy. So, both of them very much the cute 'em up. I think Ordine also was a cute 'em up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is Namco.
Yeah. And, just kind of like really branching out for what they were releasing in the U.S. and saying, the hell with marketing plans and focus testing. Let's just release these games.
Yeah, in some ways, I think they had no choice because they had to struggle trying to get Western support and having these, you know, developers that most people hadn't heard of to make these weird, you know, Tailspin games or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then you also have like kind of slim pickings in Japan with Japanese games that may not be completely appealing. But I think they just sort of had no choice but to embrace their sort of underdog status and be like, yeah, we're for the sophisticated gamers who know about things in Japan and would appreciate these shooters and whatnot.
But if you go look at the hundreds of Japanese releases, you realize, oh, hundreds of these are licensed. That's why a lot of them didn't come out here. Or they're like visual novels, adventure games, which, you know, wasn't a genre that could really work in America at that time. Yeah. And that kind of brings me to like, you know, a legendary could have been. Like, what if Snatcher had come out in America on...
What if Tokimeki Memorial
Or Tokimeki Memorial,
right.
Right. Which like, you know, like that game for PC Engine like set the tone for like a whole, you know, like generation of dating games.
But we did get some interesting oddities, like The Legend of Heroes from Falcom.
Yes.
Like surprisingly, that one entry in the franchise showed up, and then Legend of Heroes wouldn't show up again for more than a decade.
It's still going today.
Yep.
Yeah.
The Trails of
the Sky.
Cold Steel?
There's Trails in the Sky and Trails of Cold Steel.
Okay.
I thought we were just... Okay,
isn't there one right here?
There is one right
We were just talking about Vic Ireland and Working Designs. Was the last thing that he tried to kickstart one of those games?
His last game was Summon Night 6.
But
he did Class of Heroes.
Right. Before that,
Yeah. I just wonder what happened to him and if he's still
we
kicking.
We don't know, actually.
He was on this podcast.
He was.
Someone find him.
It's been a while since he's appeared online.
Oh, you know, looking at the list of things that never came out in America, there are some, you know, a lot of great PC Engine games that never got translated. Mm-hmm. I think paramount among them would be East 4, Dawn of East. And it's really sad that it's never had a translation. It's never been brought over because there was a different East 4 that was made for Super Famicom, Mask of the Sun, not nearly as good. But yeah, East 4, Dawn of East, probably the secret best PC Engine game.
Okay, that's a bold claim.
Apparently, there is a fan translation if you're into that sort of thing.
I might be.
Supposedly some of the games that were released just in Japan were like top of class. Like I've been told that the PC Engine version of Tower of Duraga is the definitive version of that game.
Really?
How do you feel about that?
Was
Ray?
It late?
I think so. No, maybe 90s, early 90s. But it's kind of remake-ish. They have more like guidance and stuff. It feels a bit more like an RPG.
Mm-hmm.
Very slightly, but yeah, it's a good, very good version.
Yeah, I just discovered the Game Boy version of that, which was not the faithful arcade port that I expected, but it gives you like a life bar, which makes a mm-hmm. big difference for how it plays. But apparently this one also gives you tips on, you know, each floor, like how do you find the thing?
Yeah.
So kind of the appealing definitive version.
Best home version.
Well, and really some of the Super CD games like Rondo of Blood or East 4 or Sapphire, like some of these games at the end, if you play them, the graphics are pushing the PC Engine so hard, it's hard to believe this is the same thing that played the games back in 1990.
Yeah, Sapphire is a game that pretty much launched an entire cottage industry of PC Engine bootlegs, because that game, even a decade ago, was selling for like $800 or $900. Yeah. I can't imagine what it's selling for now, but like that was kind of the explosion of PC Engine piracy, was people like making fake Sapphires, and there had to be guides online. Like, how do you tell if you have a real Sapphire or a fake Sapphire? Well, there's a very slight difference in some of the printing quality, yeah, and the orange is a little different on the corner.
And then they re-released it in a collection for PSP, which is also now super expensive.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I shouldn't have gotten rid of that one.
Mm. I'm glad I still have it.
Alas. But other interesting things released just in Japan. Gekisha Boy, which became kind of like a
–
it was like a breakout star of the early emulation era, where people were experimenting with you know, like, hey, here's a bunch of ROMs that I found. Let's play with this. And it's a game where you're – it's a very cartoonish game where you're a kid with a camera, like you're – basically like an amateur photojournalist.
David
and
Goldman.
Taking photos of things all around. And
this game rules. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's totally not a PC
funny.
In any way,
yeah,
by the way.
Crass.
It's of its time, but it's like a Living Mad magazine page you're just walking across. It's crazy.
Exactly, yes.
We mentioned Sapphire, Tokimeki Memorial, the first kind of breakout dating sim. Steam Hearts, the naughty shoot 'em up that was officially licensed.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of naughty games on this platform.
Yeah, especially toward the end on disc, because it was so cheap to make disc games. There's a unique Zevius sequel, Fardrout Saga.
I'm curious about that, actually. Yeah, I kind of want to check that out.
It's basically – well, it's two things. It's a very good arcade port from – I mean, Compile developed the whole thing. So they made
really?
Very good.
Oh,
yep,
so you don't
yep.
like it.
It's okay.
I love Compile.
So they did
a
very good port of the arcade version, then made a separate mode, which is basically like a sequel, and out of all the different Zevius semi-sequels there are, this one's pretty good.
Also, coming to Retronauts, I just had the thought, the kind of thought I only have when I come to tape this thing is like, oh, I need to get a copy of Zevius 3DG for PS1, which I've never thought about my whole life, but this morning I'm like, shit, I don't own that.
It's like $12.
You'll be
fine.
Complete?
It's a common one.
Really? Okay, yeah. Good to hear.
There was a unique Load Runner sequel, Battle Load Runner.
And that was kind of late, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was fairly late.
Came out same time as that first Bomberman.
Oh, okay. So not that late.
But also some weird things like Popful Mail or Linda Cube, like lots of interesting RPGs that, you know, may have gone other places other after here. Or like the Choaniki series existed here in Japan.
Right. Good old Choaniki.
Yeah.
Lots of great arcade ports that were very unique to that system. 1943 Kai, March and Maze. I probably mispronounced that.
Märchen
Maze. Okay. I am not German.
Not a good port, though.
The original version of Pocky and Rocky, Kiki Kai Kai. So lots of, just interesting things that I think are easy to pick up and play if you're an importer and don't speak Japanese, because you don't need a lot of Japanese proficiency to play Kiki Kai Kai.
True. But the other thing is that because there were so many arcade ports, at least on card, it's like now you kind of don't need to play them. Because, we have the original accurate arcade versions so readily available now.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are on compilations, not all of them.
But you could just download them also, is what I'm saying.
But this thing they said, what does Power Drift look like on this hardware?
Yeah, you might be asking. That's fine, yeah.
Not amazing.
I mean, another thing that's interesting about PC Engine is there were the Summer Carnival games. They're kind of like these temporary kind of things.
Do you want to explain that?
Ray, why about you?
Right, one of the Summer Carnival games called Al's a Dick, and that's from Nacktsatz.
That's the best one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Explain
yeah.
Summer Carnival, though.
It was kind of like Nacktsatz's little development competition. Some people would submit
Little mini-game, small games, small shooters, yeah.
I guess some of it was internal. I don't know the exact story, but that's where also, God dang it, what was the Famicom one? Rekka, that's right.
Yeah, Rekka.
Yeah, but
Rekka
each year there'd be one of these releases with these little shooters on.
So they moved on to PC Engine. It's very good, fast, hardware-pushing shooters, just similar to what Hudson was doing with the Soldier series and their caravan modes and things, but this was Nacktsatz's version, and they're also very good shooters.
Yeah, I think we often think back to the Genesis and Turbo era as when shmups ruled, and I think this is kind of another.
Absolutely.
If you look at the lineup, a lot of the greatest games are side-scrolling or vertical shooters, and I think this was the end of that era. It was never to come back again. So if you ever do get this console, just know that hopefully you're into that genre
Well, I think picking up a PC Engine Mini or TurboGrafx Mini is a good way to kind of get a sampler of the system. If you missed out on all the virtual console releases, just to say is this my thing? Do I like the aesthetic here? Do I like the games? Because it is a really good sampling of the best of the platform in both regions, which is I will say this for Konami. They bought Hudson in what, like the mid 2004,
I think they actually bought him out towards like 2008 or 9 or something.
Okay, I thought it was a little before that. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, so they've owned Hudson for more than a decade. And I feel like they've actually done a pretty good job of keeping the Hudson legacy kind of going with the PC Engine, the TurboGrafx, through Virtual Console mm-hmm. and now through the PC Engine Mini. I feel like actually Konami does a better job with Hudson's legacy than with its own. I mean, we do have those recent series anniversary collections for modern platforms, Castlevania, Contra, Gradius, or I guess it's just like arcade shooters. Anyway.
Arcade classics, yeah.
Yeah, arcade classics.
Yeah, they made a new Bomberman.
Yeah.
And then a girly Bomberman for arcades.
Hudson superfans will remember the PS2 GameCube era when there were a short-lived series mm-hmm. of like remakes.
Cubic Load Runner and...
There was a Bonk and
There was a Bonk that looked like Yoshi's Story.
There was also an Adventure Island and they were not so great.
They weren't.
Yeah.
No. Hudson needed some help. There was the Bonk sequel that was supposed to come out for Xbox Live Arcade mm-hmm. and died when Konami bought.
They did
the
release
company.
One for like Java cell phones.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. I think we talked about that on our Bonk episode.
But on the whole, I think Konami has done a pretty decent job of keeping the Hudson legacy alive without actually doing much new with it. They are at least keeping a lot of these games in circulation and keeping the memory of PC Engine, TurboGrafx alive to a certain degree.
Like, but what's sad weird to me is like if I think about the legacy of what is the flavor of this whole thing. Like every Thanksgiving, I go back to where I'm from. We play – me and my friends have a big party. We play Saturn Bomberman. And when you play Saturn Bomberman – a lot of the guest characters are like a bunch of rando people from games that were popular on PC Engine. It's like, oh, people from Far East of Eden.
Yeah, you remember it's Majimaru. Bonk. Yeah.
It's Bonk. It's Majimaru. It's, the
Princess Tomatoes
Milan
here.
From Milan's Secret Castle. And it's like, that's ultimately the thing. It's like Sega had Sega, Nintendo had Nintendo, and NEC Hudson, on the best day, it was a rogues gallery. And I think like the flavor of this console
still better than Jaleco's Pinball Party.
You're right. Cast. But like that's kind of like this is always going to be the third estate. It's never going to be like, oh man, this all you need is these games.
That's true, but I mean, you know, that's a spice of life, isn't it?
It's better than Jaguar. It's better than Jaguar.
Yeah, right.
That a Bubsy, come on. And Trevor McFerrin.
Bubsy's still around. Bubsy is somehow still relevant. There have been two new Bubsy games in the last 5 years.
But is he in Bomberman yet?
God, no. Yeah.
All right, final thoughts on the TurboGrafx 16 or PC Engine. We've been so bad about being consistent with what we call it.
Oh, my final thoughts are I'm really excited for the PC Engine Mini or TurboGrafx Mini. I don't buy a lot of these mini consoles because they tend to be games I've already played too much of, and that's not the case with this.
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like I did buy the SNES Classic. I didn't even open it because it is like pearls before swine for me where it's just like I can just play these anytime I want at any time in my life. I don't need this tiny plastic box to do it. But with these, it's different. I have to try a bit harder. So I'll be jumping back into these for the first time in like since the Wii Virtual Console.
Yeah. And plus every region gets everybody's games. So
that's nice too.
So No shenanigans like on Genesis.
And I want to give a shout out to Cron Turbo video series by our friend Dr. Sparkle. He's been on hiatus for that one for a while, but that's just like his Crontendo series, and it does explore probably like 50 or 60 of the games so far. So that's fun to look into. Yep.
Also, I'm excited to revisit it. I kind of forgot that I'd pre-ordered it because the pre-order went up so early. It's like, oh yeah, that thing is coming out in a few months, and I'll have it. And it's been a while since I've hooked up my old Real Duo, so I'm eager to revisit it. I'm excited that a new group of people will experience it. But it definitely, you know, to me, it is an anomaly. It's interesting. It's not my favorite, but I'm glad it existed.
Yeah, I'd say it's better than buying a Real system because they're all dead capacitors by now. You know, I would characterize the PC Engine not as an underdog in Japan, but it is an underdog here. But you just flip that around because Sega was more of an underdog in Japan, but the Genesis was very big here. And, you know, you need that balance, and especially in the game industry where it's so hard, I think, to support three systems, at least back then. I think now in these new generations, the companies are getting more used to things and how to adapt and such. But, you know, back then, when it was just like NEC, this electronics company that made TVs and computers and stuff, all of a sudden trying to market a game system. You know, that's not easy for them, but, you know, someone, I guess, had to take the mantle and take the role of the third pillar, that underdog. And so, again, that's what I mean by the spice of life, is that we need that sort of originality. And that's what makes it so fun to talk about as well.
And finally, I really need to play more TurboGrafx because I keep buying the games and the systems and then not making time to play with them. And that's a shame. So that's a commitment from me to you. I will play more of these games. And then I'll be like, hey, we should do another episode on TurboGrafx because now I actually know what I'm talking
about.
How about
another video series?
Yeah, no.
More video series, Jeremy.
Absolutely not.
Start at least three more.
Full
playthrough of Tailspin for
the graphics. Make that Darkwing Duck. You're hired.
Anyway, I am very old and very tired. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and you are listening to Retronauts. Thanks, Ray. Thanks, Shane. And thanks, Bob, for joining us to talk about the TurboGrafx on the eve or maybe shortly after the TurboGrafx Mini has arrived. Hopefully you, the audience, have enjoyed listening to this. And I'm afraid I will not be doing a Cron Gaming series about PC Engine because it's already been done. Thank you, Dr. Sparkle.
You can do TurboGrafx. That's a short one.
Yeah, oh. I actually have thought about that.
It's less than Virtual Boy.
Chris Kohler has all six games, so I might do that one.
He has Darius Alpha?
I believe so. Wasn't Darius Alpha not actually a TurboGrafx game?
It's cross-compatible.
Yeah, it's
but
enhanced.
It counts.
It's enhanced on...
It still costs like $2,000.
It's really expensive. I don't know if he has that one, but I think he might.
Wow.
Because that's the kind of thing...
I'll tune in for that.
All right. Anyway, that's as far as I'm going to take it. But you, the audience, can go play some TurboGrafx games and PC Engine games on the PC Engine TurboGrafx Mini whenever it launches in March 20th. Of 2020, which is like right now as you're listening to this. So you should do that. There's some really great games on there.
And play it only in the PC Engine GT filter.
Yes, absolutely. You want to not be able to see what's happening
That's
in order
what I'm
to get
doing.
The most out of it. All right. God bless. Anyway, yeah, looking forward to that and to kind of acquainting myself with some more of these games. So this has been Retronauts, an episode of Retronauts that you can find on the internet. That's how you're listening to it right now. You can find many, many other episodes of Retronauts on the internet. Go to Retronauts.com or look us up on your favorite podcast download platform. We're probably going to be there. You can also support us through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. If you subscribe for $3 a month, you get to enjoy every weekly episode a week in advance of its public release at a higher bitrate quality than on the public release and with no advertisements or sponsorship messages. So it's a superior experience all around. At $5 a month, you also get Patreon exclusive episodes every other Friday and also weekly columns by Diamond Fight about the history of video games. It's really good stuff. Check it out. Enjoy. And thank you for your support. Anyway, let's go around the table and everyone else can talk about your stuff.
You can find me on Twitter at ShaneWatch, all one word, ShaneWatch.
All right. Well, you know, I keep forgetting to plug my podcast, No More Whoppers, here on Retronauts. That's the thing. But now that it is now part of the Greenlit Network along with Retronauts, it behooves me to tell you that my podcast is No More Whoppers. I do it with my friend Alex, who lives in Japan.
Why are you so mean to him on Twitter?
We're friends.
Yeah, I feel like you're always kind of like, you know,
it's tough
poking
love.
Fun at him, it's, being mean
no,
to him.
It goes both ways, man.
We're a couple of jokesters. We gotta razz each other every now and then. That's at nomorewhoppers.tumblr.com or greenlitpodcasts.com. And I'm on Twitter as RDBAAA. I also have sort of a game company label thing called Bipedal Dog. That's at bipedal.dog. We made a game called Blast Rush. That's on mobile. Check it out.
And I'm Bob Mackey. I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo. I have a lot of other podcasts at the Talking Simpsons Podcast Network. You can find that at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. The podcasts, of course, are Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. Those are available wherever you find podcasts. We also have a lot of bonus podcasts, over 100 bonus podcasts, available on our Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. Thank you.
And finally, you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. And you can watch my video series, which have nothing to do with PC Engine or TurboGrafx, on YouTube. Look up Video Works, NES Works, Game Boy Works, Virtual Boy Works, whatever. I'm there. You can also find me writing stuff for and with Limited Run Games. It's pretty much the stuff that I do here at Retronauts, but for a corporate overlord. Very exciting. Anyway, That's it. Go play some PC Engine or TurboGrafx or whatever the hell you want to call it. Just don't invest in a super graphics. It's not worth it.